Welcome to the DMZ, and how are you this fine day, sir?
I got two kids, Matt.
Yeah. Which makes you like twice the man that I am.
More kids, more problems. There should be a Time magazine cover for me. Either one kid doesn't sleep through the night, or, as in this case, both kids do sleep through the night, which should be, you know, heaven sent, but then the older kid wakes up still yawning and cranky and bouncing off the walls, and you can't win. You never catch up. You never get equilibrium.
It doesn't get better. That's our slogan. That's our campaign slogan.
It gets worse.
It gets worse. A PSA. The more you know.
So if I'm a little off, a little cranky, a little incoherent, you know, that's why.
Well, the It Gets Worse campaign continues. And by the way, I have this issue. My son now likes to come up and grab me by the pants, because that's as far as he can reach, and pull me places that he wants me to take him to do his bidding. And this is not cool when I'm wearing dress slacks as I am today, and when his hands are messy as they always are. So I'm walking around now with like stains that people may suspect are something other than messy hands. So it gets worse.
I mean, you need to either, you know, lay down the law with your kid or petition Tucker Carlson to go casual Friday all week.
The more you know. Actually, it's casual all the time here, so there's no mandate that I wear anything. In fact,
is it the conservative definition of casual differs from the liberal one?
No, it is.
you can do blue jeans in the office?
Absolutely, I do blue jeans most days. I mean, people don't understand the Daily Caller is pretty libertarian in many ways. I mean, there was a guy who doesn't work here anymore, but I mean, I think he lived here for a while, and he like sort of like Creed on The Office, and I think he lived in a commune. It's a really it is not Alex P. Keaton conservatism here. I'm probably the most
are there conservative communes?
Movement? You understand, like, you know, the whole conservative thing, you know, there's like, there's Republican, the Mr. Republican, and that's like an obvious stereotype. But there's like, conservatism bleeds over into, it's multifaceted. And so, it's not necessarily your father's conservatism. Always at play.
Anywho.
Anyway.
What's on your mind this week?
So there's a lot going on. We can talk about Bain in a little bit. I think that's been driving. But I wanted to talk a little bit about writing and how it pertains to some changes that've been going on with me. And I thought, I'm sure you have similar experiences you could share. I think that being a blogger, being a writer, is sort of a game of constant adjustments. You know, like golf players have to change their swing. Baseball players change their batting stances now and again. And I think that writing is sort of the same way, at least for me, psychologically it is. So I'm doing some things different, and hopefully it'll have a better result. One of the things is for the past, you know, probably 5 years, I was very promiscuous in my media appearances. I basically had a philosophy: if someone invites me on to go on TV or whatever, radio, I will always say yes. And maybe that was smart. Maybe that was the right thing to do starting out. And I mean, certainly it helped me kind of make a name for myself. But some things have happened. So, for example, I've not been on MSNBC, which I used to be on all the time, for months now. And interestingly, it seems to coincide with the Daily Caller's expose of media matters and feeding talking points to other outlets, which interestingly had nothing to do with
you. You're not turning them down. They haven't been calling you.
Well, there is a bit of sour grapes involved in this, but sometimes necessity is the mother of invention. And so I would have probably kept doing that channel and others as well. But these events happen and you start to reevaluate your life and yourself and think, well, this has changed, and maybe it's not something I necessarily sought out, but maybe it's an opportunity for me to reevaluate things. And it's actually led me to turn down a lot of other opportunities and things and media appearances, because it made me start to think, what happens when you're always doing TV? Well, for one thing, you're sort of always on defense. You know, they call you and say, can you come on in 3 hours, or can you come on tomorrow? And it's rarely to talk about the story you wrote. It's usually to talk about a story you didn't write. So you sort of have to always be following the news, which makes you sort of a slave to the news cycle, which I think can lead to, in my case, I think a sort of a mild depression of constantly being chained to the news. I mean, Bill, I did things that are, you know, that I'm not proud of. For example, I would say, like, let's not go out of town on Memorial Day, because they might need me, because a lot of, you know, the big time people, they leave town for holidays, and so they may need me, or I can get on TV. So let's go the week after Memorial Day. I mean, this is like really pathetic stuff. And it's also just time consuming. I mean, people don't realize that if you want to do if you're on TV, well, in some cases, they bring you up to New York or New Jersey to be on TV for 5 minutes. You could travel right. 7 hours. But in other cases, even if it's in D.C., schlepping you there in the car, you know, sort of the prep time, studying what you're going to talk about, getting on the makeup, all that stuff. I mean, then you maybe sit in the chair for a half hour before you go on. It's time consuming, and it's time that you're not writing, you're not doing your actual job. So in any event, my hope is that I'm sort of changing up a little bit my philosophy, my mentality, and by not being tied to watching TV all the time, I feel like my hope is that my writing will now, instead of following the talking points of the day or the topic of the day, and granted, there's always going to be a little bit of that. You're always going to have to comment on what's happening in the world, but maybe coming up with things that are a little more unique to me, as opposed to always chasing the story. Anyway, that is a long soliloquy. I turn it over to you because I think there's a discussion.
Well, I guess what I think you're doing is right as far as wanting to be a value added in the national conversation, because when you get in the cable news hamster wheel. And I took a couple spins on it myself, and I fill out the Rolodex as well. But you know, when you have those 5 minute slots, and you're on with three other people, so maybe you get to literally say three sentences over the course of the segment. You really can't say anything insightful. All you can do is maybe right. give a very standard talking point.
If you try to say something thoughtful, you will be interrupted. Right. There's no time for that, so you've got
right.
to just.
And so, you're really just serving a function of filling time for the cable station, so they can make ad revenue profits. So you don't really get much out of it yourself, unless you're under contract with them, which often is a significant contract. But if you're just being tapped on the shoulder to help them fill time, you're just slave labor to them, right. and you're not.
In fairness, it's hard to overestimate how significant it is being on TV. Like, there, even in this day and age when there are a million channels and you know, it used to be if you made it on Johnny Carson, if you were a comedian and you got booked on Johnny Carson, you were set. One appearance, and if it went well, you were set, and that made a career. The phone would not stop ringing the next day. Obviously, it's not quite the same. It's not even close to the same today. But still, by virtue of being on TV, you are imparted with a certain cachet and a certain degree of expertise that has no bearing on reality, of course. So I do think that I certainly have gotten something out of it. It has certainly helped my career. But to everything, there is a season. And while I'm not going Well, I'm not saying I'm not going to ever do TV again. I certainly will. I'm going to be much more selective. And by the way, saying no is, like, really liberating. It's a scary thing to do at first because you're like, who the hell am I? I need them more than they need me. But once you start to say no to something, there's a certain it kind of feels good, Bill. There's something good about it. The more you know, it gets worse.
So my question for you is, are you going to be able professionally to be able to write from a wider, more wide lens perspective and not just make sort of, you know, teeny tiny observations on you know, news of the minute? And I'm thinking about it. I don't know, probably most people haven't read this, but if and I'm not a big Wired magazine fan, that's why I missed it at first. But Wired magazine had a piece out about a month ago about the dominance of A/B testing in the web design world and also in the professional email world, where instead of decisions being dictated by what's called HIPPO, highest paid person's opinion, that every internal office disagreement is settled by data, that you have one idea for a headline, you have a different idea for a headline, you have an idea for an email subject line, yours is different, you think that the donate button on the website should be over here and this guy thinks it should be over here, that you test it out. You take a sample of your list or your web audience. You do it one way here, do it one way there, and you see who wins and the data. And back in the day, you wouldn't get instantaneous data to settle that dispute, so you'd have to go more on your gut. Now you can get that data within minutes, settle the score, and then pick one direction and go. I've been resistant to this type of thinking for a while because it felt like you could test out two things and not know why one was better than the other. Sure, one headline might be better than the other, but if you didn't know why, what lessons could you learn from it? So if you can't learn from it, how can you replicate it? And the Wired article points out that amongst people who are the biggest proselytizers of this is that it doesn't matter. Things are always changing all the time anyway, so who cares what the lessons are? You do it this way now, and you do it a different way later, and who cares? So I get into all that to ask you, do you think you're going to be able to, you know, give yourself some elbow room, maybe write more infrequently, but try to offer more unique individualist insights, whether or not they get the clicks. If it turns out that you aren't getting the clicks, is there going to be more pressure put upon you? Look, we need you back on the hamster wheel. We need quantity of content, not quality of content, because that's what keeps the eyeballs. And people just want to keep checking things out every minute. And if you're not giving them fresh stuff, they're going to go somewhere else. Do you have to suffer that kind of pressure, or are you being given a platform to say, we want Matt Lewis to be Matt Lewis, and that's going to be better for the operation as a whole?
Very good question. I would say that, first of all, there is no external pressure put on me, but there's a tremendous amount of internal pressure coming from myself. No one opens my door and says, Lewis, damn it, I need 5 blog posts. And, like, that just doesn't happen. But I am highly conscious of the fact that there are a lot of very talented writers out there who do not have jobs and who are not paid and do not make money, and that I'm incredibly blessed to be able to do what I do, and that I could be back at the gas station tomorrow or managing the fast food restaurant. All these are jobs that I've had in my past. And I think there's a sort of a healthy fear that's a motivator. but no, there isn't any external. Now, I think that – now, my goal is not – my goal right now is not to do less blogging. I feel like it's not a matter of doing long-form content versus quick blog posts. It's a matter of driving the debate and not necessarily being on the hamster wheel, not playing defense but playing offense. And so I think that, you know, the time that I save from doing quite as many media appearances could be devoted into writing more long-form material. But no, I have no intention to quit doing frequent blog posts. In fact, I hope to do more, but I hope that they're by and large even more insightful and less less derivative. I have a podcast, as you know, where I interview lots of interesting people. You've been on it. Robert Wright was on it recently. Ross Douthat was on it recently. Mm-hmm. Jonathan Merritt, who's an author. So we delve into some deep topics, religion, culture. So I do have that as an outlet. The one thing that I don't do is I don't pay attention to metrics. I intentionally avoid knowing, like, how many paid views I have. I do pay attention to things like how many Twitter followers I have. And I advise young – one of the things I advise young people – I was just telling – I have a new intern, a great young guy named Justin Green, who got the internship by criticizing me. He wrote a piece, he's from Nebraska, and he wrote a piece criticizing something I wrote about the Nebraska Senate race. We talked about it here. He's a Deb Fischer fan, and he ended up landing the internship because of that. So sometimes if you're smart, if you write smart analysis, you can be critical and you won't be blocked, and some of you will be, so blocked on Twitter. So where was I going with this?
Metrics.
So I don't pay attention to page views. I don't want to be a slave to that either. So I don't test things out like that. I'm more concerned, like yesterday I wrote something, and it was Mark, I think it's Thiessen, at the Washington Post, had written something. I commented on it. He wrote a piece at the American Enterprise Institute's blog commenting on my commenting on his Washington Post piece. And another fellow at the American Conservative wrote a piece, Jordan Bloom wrote a piece commenting on that. So that made me happy. That's not really a metric, but that's the kind of thing that I really care more about is am I driving discussion, driving the debate? The advice that I gave my intern yesterday, and that I frequently give young people, is if you want to be a blogger or a writer, being a good writer is, in the modern world, just one of the many things you need to worry about. You really have to build a brand. I mean, if I interview two people and they're equally good writers, but one of them has 10,000 Twitter followers and one of them has 200, you probably hire the one who has 10,000 Twitter followers. And what I told him is that I'm guessing he spends 90% of his time thinking about writing and 10% of his time building his social media following. But in reality, his value is probably more 50-50 in terms of getting hired. So he should really spend more like half of his time building his brand, being platform agnostic, doing TV, especially when you're starting out, doing podcast interviews, getting a Twitter following. To me, those are metrics which I would call I would say it's sort of like developing personal capital, and it's transferable. So if you go – like think of Andrew Sullivan. Like he's a very good writer, but he goes from outlet to outlet, and essentially he can take his audience with him. That's transferable capital that he owns. And I know there's this thing now where like some companies feel like they own your Twitter feed or your Facebook page, but by and large, as a writer, if you can create this infrastructure, this brand, it makes you a much more marketable commodity in this highly competitive workforce.
I have not figured out, this is, if we want to turn the show into Bill shares our career failings, I have not figured out how people advance their careers by jumping from place to place every couple of years. You know, Andrew Sullivan is sort of the master at that, but also you look at, you know, Ezra Klein or Matthew Iglesias or Dave Weigel, though Weigel is sort of, you know, forced to jump.
Yeah.
But they have always, you know, it almost seems like as soon as they get to a new place, they're looking around, like, where can I go next? Not to do something different, just to do what they already do in a different place. And by the act of moving, it looks to the wider world that they're advancing. someone else wanted them, so they must be doing something good, you know?
Well, there's also the grass is always greener mentality that everyone kind of has.
Right.
I mean, it's and human nature.
The way my brain is wired is I just want to find my place and just settle and do my thing and stop bothering me, and that doesn't seem to be the right approach.
No, I think
career advancement in this world.
Here's what I think. If 99% of jobs suck and most bosses are jerks, and if you find a place where you can work and they let you do what you want to do, do not leave, because it is rare that you find that. And so, you know, I've changed jobs about every 2 years, but not on purpose. I mean, I was at townhall.com, and I was more than happy. I was very happy there. And then there was sort of a takeover by the Salem folks, and my boss got fired, and my time was essentially limited. So I got basically pushed out with a very soft landing. They were kind enough to kind of let me phase out. And then I went to AOL's Politics Daily, and I loved it. Was very happy there. I was there for about 2 years. I'd still be there today, but Arianna Huffington basically took over. And, you know, obviously her political ideology and mine don't mesh. That was one of the factors. There were others. And now here I'm at the Daily Caller and love it and very happy and have every intention. I could be here for another 20 years. Or they could sell it for $315 million to Tina Brown or something. I mean, you know, who knows? Who knows what happens? And I just think part of it is that in the media world today, there's so many changes that aren't even, it's not me wanting to leave. It's that situations happen, things happen that sort of expedite. But look, I think that the key is, as a writer, and you should always be loyal to the place you work. You should do your best work for them. You should, you know, I'm all for being like a good employee and all that. And but you should also, in a way, if you consider yourself a brand, and you should consider that, like, you are building an audience, and ideally, if you got fired or whatever, you could, some of that is transferable equity that you've accumulated. What you don't want to be is in a position where everything that you have is due to, like, what if, like, all you have is the fact that you go on this cable network and then you lose it? Then you're screwed. Then you're sort of like the person who traded on their looks and then they lost their looks. You got to diversify a little bit, you know?
Well, let me shift gears, because I do want to get to this big idea that we've been meaning to do for a few shows now that was suggested by one of our commenters.
Oh, and before we get there, though, whatever happened to our theme song? Is that being worked on by our people?
I need to talk to our people. I'm not sure where our people are with that, but I will talk to the people. And make sure that the people are on it.
I think it would be fun. I think what we should do is take that one. There's one song that was pretty good that was like a 70s theme. And we should do a film shoot where we're like bouncing the ball, walking down the street, kind of like what's happening. We should include lots of like tropes and cliches from various 70s shows. And actually just film. And I'm sure there's an unlimited budget to do all this. But I think that we should have a regular opening to the show. Not just the song, but also with the video.
Well, any kind of montage, I'm completely for.
That would be great, yeah.
Some kind of little buddy movie sort of deal.
Yeah. There's a lot of directions we could go with this thing. A lot of directions. And by the way, I think I mentioned this last time. I keep watching these Netflix movies. Like, now I'm watching Magnum P.I. and The A-Team. It's like, so I'm really...
So you're an hour-long 80s drama guy.
Yes.
I'm more of an 80s sitcom guy. I wasn't into the Simon and Simon type stuff.
Oh, I'm like you, though. Back in the 80s, I only watched the half-hour sitcom.
Okay.
Now, I'm going back retroactively and watching some of these on Netflix.
Anywho, so here's what Jeff Oster suggested to us a couple weeks ago. He said, I want to know how much you guys think that your own political worldviews are determined by the times in which you live. I know that Matt is a fan of Edmund Burke and other proto-conservative philosophers, and I'm curious if he had lived during Burke's time, whether he would see the world the same way that he does now, looking back from the 21st century. Similarly, could Bill imagine living in a much more liberal time when he would be considered a conservative and embrace a conservative affiliation as a product of it, or would he be even more liberal than he is now? The reason I ask is, us characters in the Peanut Gallery do a lot of time traveling, haggling over perceptions of what is left-wing and what is right-wing, and it's clear to me that so much of how we see our own politics is more of a product of our ideas about history and where we stand in relationship to it. My own views are conservative by today's standards, but I wonder if I was born in 1880, I would see myself as a liberal for my time. I wonder if actually being a conservative or being liberal is more of a personality temperament that transcends the issues of the day. What say you, Mr. Lewis?
Well, it's a fascinating question, and I don't have an answer, but I will. It spurs several thoughts, so I'll just go through them quickly. Again, fascinating question. One of the things that I think about is I think about in Britain when the first vote to outlaw the slave trade, there were four people who voted to outlaw the slave trade. It was Edmund Burke, William Wilberforce, William Pitt, and another guy whose name I don't remember but was very important. So four in all of Parliament. And obviously Burke is sort of the quintessential conservative, and so I would like to think that I would have been one of them, but you know, the argument against it was that, well, we've had slavery and it's very important to our business, and Britain may not be as strong if we give it up. Those are just like, in a way, conservative arguments. So there's like a really big important vote that I would hope, I would like to believe that I would have been on the Burke, Wilberforce, Pitt side of the debate. Another thing this makes me think of is Theodore Roosevelt, who, Glenn Beck has sort of, railed against for being a progressive, but Theodore Roosevelt, one of the things that he sort of pushed for was the FDA, I guess he had read what's the famous book?
The Jungle, right?
The Jungle, and the sausage being made and food and all that. Part of what ideology is, for me at least, it's and we had this debate a few weeks ago where I said, I'm not worried at all. Like, the notion that social conservatives are going to create some sort of a theocracy, I find laughable. If I thought that was actually going to happen, I would, like, campaign against it, work against it. But I think it's much more likely that secular progressives will somehow undermine America than... So in other words, it's not that I trust the extreme right any more than I trust the extreme left, but I just think it's much more likely that our downfall, our problems are going to come from the left. If we were driving, and this is a weird analogy, but if we were driving to Omaha, and that was our goal to get to Omaha, and we were in Maryland, and I said, go west, that would be good advice. If we were in Nevada, I would say go east. That doesn't mean that I've changed my positions. It means that now we need to go east, right?
You're not left or right. You're pro-Omaha.
I am Omaha, somewhere in middle America, to quote the Counting Crows. So my point is,
what is your North Star in all this? What is your constant? What is your Desmond? What is it that would transcend time?
It's a little thing I like to call the good. No, I mean, that is
so
the...
So you're saying it's about outcome, not about distribution of power, per se. There's an actual result that you want to see occur.
Well,
I agree with that, I think, than traditional conservatism, if that was the case.
Well, let me get back to that, but let me just finish up this point. Theodore Roosevelt, if I were alive when Theodore Roosevelt were president, as much as I don't like government intrusion, as much as I think regulation today is incredibly harmful, and as much as I realize that there is a slippery slope, I think it's a pretty good thing that we can trust the food we eat. So I think I'd probably be with TR on that one. And maybe that makes me in some ways not conservative. Let me, the last analogy.
Well, I think George Will once said, you know, I think he had a column several years back mocking libertarians, you know, saying sort of the cesspool of college dorm room conversation, and that that you could be a conservative and be for limited government, and not be an idiot and think that any government is inherently flawed. That you should have a police force. You know, there's some basic things that even a believer in limited government can acknowledge are good. And I think you can say having a FDA, having someone inspect the meat, doesn't necessarily mean that you're not conservative.
I think you're totally right, and I think George Will is right, and I think you should keep quoting him and reading him. the last sort of historical look I will take is, I wonder, even in like 1960, I mean, there's a lot about John F. Kennedy that I think is in many ways closer to modern conservatism than, say, like maybe what Robert Taft was espousing. And, you know, Kennedy cut taxes. Kennedy was obviously Barony Bird and Panty Price. I tend to believe that American culture changed dramatically after the assassination of John F. Kennedy. America in 1962 was radically different than America in 1968. I can't think of any. I mean, I think that from 1980 to today is more similar, despite the rise of the internet, than 1962 to 1968. And so I think that was a time of just rapid change, and I think the left became radicalized during that time. And so I would even say it is possible that I could have voted for John F. Kennedy in 1960.
I don't believe that.
Okay, why not? I said possible.
I'm with you on TR. I don't think you'd go Kennedy over Nixon.
I don't know. You tell me why I would.
Well, I mean, I do think that some folks on the right have a little oversimplified Kennedy's tax position back then. I mean, yes, he did want to lower the top tax rates as part of a broader reform, but you know, he wasn't a supply sider. You know, he was talking about going down from like, you know, 90 to 70. And the debate at the time that LBJ actually had to carry over the finish line because JFK didn't actually get it done himself, that the conservatives of the day were resisting, was that the argument was this was not just going to be you know, tax simplification and whatnot, but it was going to be a boost to the economy. The economy needed a jolt. You know, it was a Keynesian argument that they were making, and the conservatives of the day were diehard, you know, budget balancers, and they thought it was being too loosey goosey with the balance sheet to play with the tax code in that way. And LBJ had to put together a coalition and also play upon the martyrdom of JFK to actually, you know, push back against that argument. So, I mean, unless you think you would be you know, pro-growth over pro-balanced budget in that time, I don't think that issue would be enough for you to be a JFK Democrat as opposed to a Nixon Republican.
Well, let me say, I think you may be right. And by the way, Nixon, it's also important that Nixon in 1960 dramatically different than Nixon in 1972. I mean, in many ways, Richard Nixon in 1960, I think that loss, and he thought that it was stolen from him, and it might have been. I think that losing in 1960 sort of had Nixon spiral into the kind of paranoid, cynical Nixon that we saw. At one point, the guy was young and successful and a bit much more optimistic. I was just at the Nixon Library a couple weeks ago out in Yorba Linda. And you should go because it's not just the library, it's also the birthplace and the burial grounds. You can like, knock out three birds with one stone. I think that the bottom line here, Bill, is that this is a great intellectual exercise, but I think the fundamental point that we're making is that we all have this North Star, as you were saying. And to me, there are a couple things, and this is a process of learning and growing, and I'm still learning, but I think to me, one of the things that I really believe firmly is comes from David Brooks's observation that the essence of conservatism from Burke to Hayek is epistemological modesty, which is a belief that we are fallen creatures, that we, as Chesterton said, the only thing that you can sort of empirically prove is that man is born with a sin nature. And if you look at my pants and how my son is tries to pull me around and to do his bidding, and it is very clear to me that Chesterton was right about that. But epistemological modesty means that we know that we don't know everything, that we know that we can't fix everything, and therefore it is sort of the height of vanity to believe that we can create this utopian system, create this heaven on earth, and that is sort of doomed to failure. That is something that I believe sort of at my core. I also believe that I have a sort of strain that is in some ways at odds with modern-day conservatism, which I don't know how to define it, but it is sort of a moral crusading thing, which obviously can go – that can be misinterpreted. I'm not talking about invading countries, preemptively and trying to convert them. But what I'm talking about is a belief, and maybe this speaks to the John F. Kennedy thing, but a belief that one of our purposes here on Earth is to do good and to seek the good. And this is a little bit at odds with the epistemological modesty, because you must be modest and realize that you can't achieve heaven on earth. But it doesn't mean that you shouldn't be striving to make the world a better place. Again, these things can be at odds. But that's why some of my heroes are people like Wilberforce. And that's why I Rubio, when Rubio taught, Rubio's rhetoric, I think Kennedy's rhetoric, Reagan certainly tapped into this, tear down this wall. That is a moral purpose to, it wasn't just, realpolitik or, power. It was about a higher calling, a higher purpose. So again, great exercise, and I'm still in the process of discovery.
I had a bit of an epiphany recently because when I was a kid, one of my favorite songs growing up was Phil Oakes's "Love Me, I'm a Liberal," which is this great. I mean, it's just a great satirical song, and I always liked the intersection of politics and humor, and I thought he just really hit it on the head. I was just watching the Phil Oakes PBS documentary, their American Masters series, understanding better the political context for that song at the time. I mean, I looked at the song as a kid growing up as sort of like playful jabbing at his fellow liberals, when in actuality it was a searing indictment of a group of people who were being called liberals as opposed to himself, who was a radical. And this is the time when Carl Oglesby at SDS had done a big speech, chastising corporate liberalism as being insufficient to the kind of change that we really need, and deriding FDR and JFK as LBJ as being merely liberal and not sufficient to the task at hand. And it dawned on me that if I was alive at the time of Phil Oakes's "Love Me, I'm a Liberal," he'd probably be talking about me, and I'd probably be one of those liberal douchebags that he thought were screwing everything up. Because to the extent that I have an internal bias, and I say that consciously, I mean that like any bias, it could steer you wrong from time to time. But I do have a bias towards people who actually get in the mix to try to solve problems and don't just throw rocks from the outside. I'm not a pitchfork guy at my core. And I feel
like
I don't
want to overstate this, but I mean, you were seen as a conservative at your college.
Yes,
right?
But that's a totally different thing. I mean, I'm having to get into that, but that's a totally different deal.
We've talked about it here, but I mean, could you have been in a different time? I mean, okay, like on Family Ties, as I've been watching the old episodes, even Stephen Keaton once volunteered for Richard Nixon because of some girl.
That's
some
right.
young college Republican girl.
That's the pilot, I think. I think that's the Family
it's
Ties
the pilot.
Pilot.
He says something like, it's like, Diana Gelbfarb, a real fascist, but quite a fashion sense. You know, something like that. But quite a looker. But I mean, like, could you have, you know, could you have voted for Reagan in 1980?
No.
I mean, liberals did.
No. And I remember even as a kid being against Reagan in the third grade, so I know I would not. Let me address my college days in a second. What my bias is, I am sympathetic to people trying to deal with thorny situations and not trying to oversimplify it. I've been in enough personal situations where I feel like someone is on the outside criticizing what I'm trying to do, and I feel like, hey, if you knew what I knew, if you knew the nuances involved,
right,
and you appreciated them, you wouldn't necessarily think that I was, you know, a big giant sellout. And so I tend to give slack to people in those circumstances. You know, I give Obama slack on Afghanistan because to me, I see no obvious good solution there. I thought he got dropped into a terrible situation with no easy answers. Sure, I'd like everybody to be out today, but I understand that there's risk involved with whatever choice you make. I accept that he may be wrong. He may have made the wrong call here, but certainly not out of any kind of, in my view, any kind of malevolent intent. I don't think he has a nefarious desires, imperialistic desires or anything like that. He's just trying to find the best way to get out that doesn't have bad ramifications. I could see myself in the LBJ days saying, hey, give them some room on Vietnam. You know, they don't want us to be in there and killing more Americans. They don't have to be. They're not trying to send us into the abyss. Just give them some breathing space. And there's actually some evidence that I would not be totally wrong in that respect, because LBJ was trying diligently to negotiate an end to the war in 1968, and Nixon sabotaged him. And so everyone on the, because the left split in 68 and really undermined Hubert Humphrey. And Hubert Humphrey was more against the war than LBJ was. And he couldn't get a fair shake from the radical left at the time. And LBJ was trying very much to end the war before the election. And because Nixon told the South Vietnamese, hold out, wait till I'm elected and you'll get a better deal. LBJ was not able to do it. So I'm not completely out of my gourd thinking that way. But by the same token, they didn't deserve all that much slack. They clearly made a lot of decisions back then that were too political in nature. There's an argument that LBJ was just literally mentally unstable and not being rational about some of the decisions he was making, and so he certainly didn't deserve a carte blanche of blind trust, knowing what I know now and reading the history books. But I could see myself at the time not being as radical about the situation. Now, of course, maybe if I was college age, maybe it'd be a totally different story. I mean, I protested the first Gulf War because I was college age and thought I was going to get drafted. So there's always that aspect.
It sounds
to
like
worry
it might
to
be a situation where your personality would lead you to more moderate politics. So in other words, it's not your ideology, but it's your sort of more your epistemological modesty,
right,
which is leading you would lead you to be more
tactical. You know, there are certainly folks in the 60s who understandably looked at civil rights and said, you know, we've waited long enough here. Waiting is not getting us anywhere. We got to force some action. And that was very that shaped a lot of worldviews of the youth of that day, that they had to go down. They had to go on the freedom rides down south and force change.
Right. Well, let me see, this fits the driving to Omaha analogy, because
exactly,
if you're in Virginia, then going west is the right answer. If you're in Nevada, going east is the right answer. And I think that that's the problem, where people think being tough is like, so we were tough with the Soviet Union, say, and it worked. So the lesson learned is being tough is always right. Well, being right is always right, but I would say sometimes being tough, if being tough gets you what you want, then it's good. But sometimes maybe diplomacy is, you know.
Well, I think people look at the trajectory of gay rights today. You know, there did not need to be a 200,000 person march on Washington to get Don't Ask, Don't Tell repealed, or to get Obama to say gay marriage should be the law of the land.
I would argue that Obama got Don't Ask, Don't Tell repealed
in a much more quiet strategy.
I would argue that that was successful. I mean, as long as the gay rights movement was perceived as radical, and you had marches and protests and parades and people seeming to be threatening and strange, the American public was against it.
But and there was a point, becomes 20 years ago when people were
race.
There are some gay marriage activists who said, let's lead with ending bans on gays in the marriage area. Let's lead with marriage. Let's lead with sort of conservative ideals to say we want those things too. And some of the radical activists said, why are you selling out like that? Why are you prioritizing, military service and marriage? We should be pushing for other things.
Right.
But those strategic goals carried the day, and that was a politically savvy thing to do. And that's a different model than what happened with civil rights in the 60s. And that doesn't mean that Martin Luther King was wrong. And I would say, obviously, on net, what they did worked. But obviously, but there were backlashes there were backlash costs associated with it that I think if you didn't have to pay those costs, better off not to. They made, I think, a legitimate calculation that we have no choice but to pay these costs because nothing's happening. This has been 100 years and nothing's happening.
Right.
But it doesn't necessarily mean that you want to replicate that model in every single circumstance.
Yeah, I think people confuse tactics. Well, certainly people confuse tactics with strategy, but they also confuse tactics and strategy with ideology. And, our goal might be freedom, being tough, or being diplomatic. We should not be wedded emotionally to tactics or even strategy. We should be wedded to the objective. It's sort of a military thing, but I think it deserves repeating. Objective's freedom or whatever. If being tough gets me that, then fine. If being diplomatic gets me that, fine. And it's going to change. It doesn't mean that just because one thing worked once, it's always going to work. By the way, for those of you keeping score at home, we've had a couple of shorter DMZ episode, so I guess you're getting your money's worth.
We're making up for lost time.
I do want to ask the audience, and then let's close quickly with Bane. But I do want to ask people. So I'd love your comments on the big idea that we talked about, because this is, I think, at least I'll say for myself, it's a process of self-discovery. A lot of times you don't know why you believe what you believe, and that's part of the discovery. What are the underpinning, intellectual, philosophical ideal. So I'd love to get your comments on Bill and I and what you thought of that. But Bill, the last thing I wanted to talk about.
Well, just before Bane, I just want to type one loose end about my college days. Because that was the deal there was my contrarian personality. So I guess get to the question of personality.
Right,
again.
Okay.
Here I'm at Oberlin College, one of the most liberal campuses, in America, and the contrarian side of me won out. And it didn't cause me to be a conservative. I did not change my views on equal rights or abortion because I chafed at some of the excesses there. But the college political issues that I latched on to were on the conservative side of the spectrum there. And so I was considered to be a right winger by my peers at college. But I did not let that, you know, completely distort, you know, my general, you know, view of the world. And so when I graduated from college, I didn't register Republican right away. I didn't vote for George Bush in 1992. And even being under Michelle Malkin's tutelage at the Oberlin Forum newspaper, I still maintained my general liberal outlook. But I certainly picked many a fight back then. And
well, let me ask you, how do you feel about Japanese internment? I mean, are you in favor of that?
I don't think Michelle was in favor of that back then. So she'll have to speak for herself. Anyway, were you going to get into Bain for a sec?
Yeah, we don't have time to get into Bain, but I just want to make a side point about Bain, which okay. I found interesting. Conor Friedersdorf, who, of course, is a dialoguer here, and he's at The Atlantic, wrote a piece sort of criticizing Chris Matthews. Chris Matthews of Harbaugh criticized Cory Booker, and Conor Friedersdorf, who, by the way, was on the podcast recently, the Matt Lewis and the News podcast, check it out. But Connor was criticizing Chris Matthews because Matthews was criticizing Cory Booker for telling the truth about Bain, for defending private equity, and for being intellectually honest.
The premise that what he was saying was the ultimate truth, but continue.
Well, yeah, I mean, where you stand depends on where you sit on that one. But I took this sort of contrarian myself viewpoint, Bill, which is to say that he was a paraclete, that when Cory Booker agreed to become a surrogate, and that's how he was representing himself, as a surrogate of Obama, he gave up the right to be intellectually honest. This is like joining the army. If you are a campaign surrogate, you are essentially representing the candidate.
And if you're a good campaign surrogate...
If you do not believe, and we know that the Bain thing is a central premise of Obama's campaign, if you do not agree on that issue and you're not willing to defend the Obama campaign's position, then the honorable thing to do is to say no. So I don't buy this thing about praising Cory Booker for speaking truth to power, because if he were a pundit or anything other than a surrogate, then I would say that he deserved praise for playing against type. And
so you're in the Chris Matthews camp.
I am siding with Chris Matthews on this. When it's like, there's a reason I'm not in the army. But once you join the army, you cease having opinions. And that's what Cory Booker did. He joined the army, but he didn't give up his opinions.
He not only violated the surrogate code, but he waved the surrogate code around in the middle of the interview. I'm a surrogate. Here are my surrogate notes. Screw that. These ads suck.
So I think Chris Matthews was actually right in chastising Cory Booker. What Booker did was dishonorable in a sense. You don't agree to be a surrogate for somebody. A surrogate means, like, by definition, it means that you are, like, a paraclete. You are the embodiment, you are their representative. It's like they're, you know, an attorney representing you or what. I mean, you are there in their stead. And that means that you have forfeited your right to have a dissenting viewpoint. That's how it works.
I would argue that Democrats have a harder time with surrogate discipline than Republicans do. I don't know if you agree with that or not, but I feel like Democrats have a harder time having a surrogate army you can count on, you don't have to handhold, to go out there in the media and echo the messages of your guy's leader. There's going to be more instances of Democrats undermining each other, I feel, on the Republican side. But maybe the Republicans go on.
Yeah, I would disagree. And I think this is one of the things where, like, Republicans and conservatives tend to believe that they're the ones who are rugged individualists, and therefore it's harder to get them in line. Meanwhile, Democrats think, no, Republicans are businesslike, militaristic. Mm-hmm. They, you know, I think both sides bestow on the other side this organizational ability and believe that they themselves are disorganized. Now, I will say this. Compared to Bill Clinton, who had, I think, some very good surrogates, Barack Obama's had a very difficult time. And that was a problem during the health care debate, that nobody other than Barack Obama could carry the water on it.
Well, look, I mean, I still remember Bob Kerry talking about President Clinton, calling him an unusually good liar. So.
Well, again, I mean,
Clinton
again,
had his problems, too.
Honesty. No, I mean, look, there are horrific moments in surrogates, and I would guess that they're pretty bipartisan. But regardless, the thing is, I tend to agree with Chris Matthews on this, and that, I think, is somewhat newsworthy.
And Matthews has taken some shots for basically sounding, you know, why is a news anchor criticizing Cory Booker for speaking his mind? But Matthews is sort of playing an interesting role. I mean, he sort of changes his stripes in different political eras, not necessarily dishonestly, but he seems to be sort of openly supporting Obama now. And coloring his commentary through that lens, and saying and sizing up people based on their political savvy as opposed to press them, you know, whether you know you're right or wrong on the issue. And he's got to be right to do that, but some people are sort of knocking him, saying that he's being an Obama plant, which I don't think is quite right either. But I think Matthews is being transparent. He said last night that it concerns me that Obama's surrogates do such a terrible job.
Well, look, I think a couple things. I think that Connor is right in implying that Chris Matthews has become essentially a partisan hack. I think that's true. Like, I think Chris Matthews 10 years ago. Was much more interesting and much more intellectually honest than he is today. Now, I don't know if that's like a marketing decision. He saw that, you know, remember originally he was hired by Roger Ailes. And I don't know if he saw that, you know, Rachel
Maddow.
That was
not for Fox. That was for America's Talking, right?
I think this was for MSNBC.
Right, the precursor was MSNBC, which was America's Talking.
Okay.
So I think Ailes wasn't trying to do a conservative network at the time.
No. But if you work for Roger Ailes, it's going to be different than an era when MSNBC is leaning forward. And clearly, any pretense of balance is out the window. I mean, it's – I don't know whether this happened organically, whether Chris Matthews got turned off by Iraq, or whether he looked and saw, well, the direction that we're heading is Rachel Maddow and Schultz, but he's become much more partisan and much, much less balanced. Having said that, I think Chris Matthews, his book Hardball, by the way, is amazingly good. It's terrific advice for anybody who wants to learn about politics. It's philosophically neutral. And I think Chris Matthews is at his best when he's talking about the love of the game of politics. You know, he worked for Tip O'Neill and Jimmy Carter. The guy knows old school politics. And I think this... Hang on. My light went out. I think this speaks to that. This whole thing about what should a surrogate do is, in my opinion, philosophically neutral.
Well, that's why I don't think that – I think he's being partisan. I think he's being openly partisan. I don't think it's in disguise. But I don't think he's being a hack because he's still guided by the things that, you know, bug him on a given day. So right after he talks about his concern that Obama's surrogates aren't good enough, he has Debbie Wasserman Schultz on, the DNC chair and congresswoman from Florida, and he grills her about why are your surrogates so bad. What's wrong with the Democratic Party? They don't have any good surrogates. You're making the president look bad. So his driving force is playing the game well, and when he sees people not playing it well, I mean, obviously the Democratic Party doesn't want to have their tactics being mocked on cable television.
But
they don't
if you're going to mock me, if you're going to mock a party or whatever, mocking me on my tactics and process is much different than saying that I'm wrong about issue X.
It's also not party message. If he was a true hack, he'd just be talking about Bain the entire time. He wouldn't take a detour to talk about how Democratic Party apparatus is shoddy. The party doesn't like that either.
Okay. I mean, that's an interesting distinction, and I mean, maybe you're right, but go back to the Clinton administration. Chris Matthews was incredibly hard on Bill Clinton.
Incredibly hard.
He's never critical of Barack Obama. Never.
I think Chris Matthews likes Barack Obama because he doesn't have enough
surrogates.
But it doesn't mean he was more honest under Clinton. It just means he didn't like Bill Clinton. And I thought from his contrary there was bad, but I don't think it was dishonest. I think the guy didn't like him.
Well, I would say that at some point, and it seems to coincide with the invasion of Iraq, at some point Chris Matthews decided that the liberal side was right, and he hasn't. There aren't many instances of him playing against type or, praising the Republicans for doing something.
I imagine there's less internal pressure on him to play up his contrarian aspects. He may feel less internal need to emphasize that, but I do think they still arise. I don't think you watch Hardball all the time. That's nonstop cheerleading. He still finds his spots to show where he goes on his own path. But he's definitely doing it in the context of saying pretty clearly that he supports one candidate over the other. And if you don't like that, don't watch the show. I'd rather see those types of biases be open than be wrapped in fakery.
Well, the last thing I would bring up, and I think you make a good point there, and a lot of conservatives would agree with you on transparency, is the sort of selection bias. I mean, look at who he has on his show all the time. Look at who the guests are. Not a lot of diversity of opinion, much less than there used to be. It used to be that he would have on a lot. I mean, a classic example, I think, is Pat Buchanan, who's been hounded out of the MSNBC empire. So,
but he may have a hard. I mean, I see him have Republicans on. He may have a hard time booking them these days. He says that he likes the combat. He likes partisan combat. He likes to have a left and right on and be in the middle of it. So I don't think he wants to have a show that's just Democrat, Democrat, Democrat. So there are other shows, I'm assuming that are different.
Morning Joe doesn't have a hard time booking Marco Rubio or conservative voices. I certainly wouldn't say that show's a right-wing show, but they get...
It's the most conservative show on the network.
Which is...
Morning Joe's most conservative show that...
They get Paul Ryan on. And, I mean, if conservatives thought they'd get a fair shake on Chris Matthews, they would be more likely to go on. I mean, I think that... Well, anyway, we could debate this on and on, but the interesting point is that I actually agree with Chris Matthews, and I disagree with Connor, and that is newsworthy.
Yeah, that is. I agree. All right. We should call it a day, I think, Mr. Lewis.
All right. Another good DMZ episode, as always. You can follow us on Twitter, at DMZ Show.
And individually, Matt K. Lewis and Bill Scher.
And you don't even know this yet, Bill, but I think we have the Weekend Blog Facebook page.
Did you
we need some
it?
People to... Well, I've put the new DMZ picture up there.
All right.
We need about 9 people to unlike us, because if we get – there's a certain threshold that we can change the name. Right now we have too many likes.
We need unlikes?
We need 9 people to unlike us, and then we can change the official name of the thing. Otherwise,
here's your chance to express your hatred towards us.
Yes, but then you got to like us again next week. So
there you go.
Anyway, good episode. And again, I think you got your money's worth this week. I've been skimping on you lately. You've been holding out. And another classic episode. And just remember, it gets worse the more you know.
Definitely gets worse. All right, I'll catch you next week.
All right, man. Thanks.
Take care.